Welcome to Current State from WKAR News. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director at WKAR. We start with three major developments at Michigan State University, part of the fallout from the Larry Nassar scandal. Joining me now is WKAR reporter Scott Pohl.
Hi, Reginald.
And Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
They both covered two appearances by interim president John Engler this week. Let's first start with the newest news first. Scott, Engler's first MSU Board of Trustees meeting happened Friday. Any big announcements?
Well, I would say that interim president Engler and every member of the Board of Trustees, when they made remarks, tried to reassure the MSU community and the community at large that they're listening to people, they're trying to act, they're trying to make things better, they're including, they would hope you would agree, the faculty and students, and hoping to move forward amidst all of these calls that all eight members of the Board of Trustees resign and that they shouldn't have selected John Engler to be interim president. They tried their hardest to communicate that. I'm not sure they succeeded.
So, Shayna, I was looking at your Twitter page and you had some pictures of the protesters. So tell me a little bit more about their message.
Well, in some ways, this Board of Trustees meeting ended up being almost the launch or announcement in a very dramatic fashion of Reclaim MSU. It is this newer group. We've been seeing the hashtag Reclaim MSU for a while now, but now they have a more organized website, Twitter page, Instagram, all of that, where they're kind of trying to find a way to kind of organize all of these different fractions that are coming off as far as the different groups that are protesting and issues that they are coming up with against MSU. Their big issue right now, particularly at the Board of Trustees meeting, is, like Scott was saying, they don't feel like they're being listened to. They want the Board of Trustees to step down, and that is a message that they are telling people, we are not going to stop. We're not going to quietly sit aside and let you adults take over our school and decide what's best for us. We are going to have a seat at the table, whether you let us or whether we just have to take it.
Earlier this week, interim president Engler announced restructuring to health services at MSU. Scott, what is changing and what will affect students?
Well, one of the announcements made on Wednesday was put off by the Board of Trustees on Friday, Reginald. They announced that they would be renaming the College of Human Medicine, the College of Medicine. Governor Engler, now interim president Engler, explained that that's more in line with the current terminology most medical schools use. I believe in the last day or two, they've heard from some faculty members in the college that they weren't consulted. They think it's a hasty move, and the Board of Trustees has put off enacting that change until April. But along with that renaming, the dean of the MSU College of Human Medicine, Norman Beauchamp Jr., was appointed to a new position. He'll be associate provost and assistant vice president for health affairs. And there were a couple of other appointments made to new jobs. The whole idea, though, according to President Engler, was to reassure students that the wellness programs on campus will result in a system that provides safe and quality care.
And just a follow-up on that, I mean, it seems like interim president Engler is not waiting around to do any restructuring. I mean, we've seen a number of moves this week.
Well, not just this week. I believe on Friday he used the word 8 days that he's been actively working on campus. And every time I've heard him speak, he talks about meetings he has yet today, a couple of meetings that he has next week came up at the trustees meeting. He's very actively promoting how busy he is. Wouldn't you say, Shayna?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and not just interim president Engler, but also the entire board, well, multiple members on the Board of Trustees, when they were giving comments at the end of their meeting, they were talking about how they are trying to meet with different student groups, with different community members to really kind of get a grasp on what does the school need and what should they be doing going forward.
So speaking of the Board of Trustees, Shayna, earlier this week, you covered the Faculty Senate's vote of no confidence in the board. What were the comments like before the vote was taken?
Before the vote was taken, there weren't a ton of public comments. Those went on for about an hour, which was a little surprising. I usually tend to go to these things expecting for multiple hours of comment because people do have a lot of concerns they want to talk about. But one of the things that a professor who ended up voting against the measure was concerned about was that it was making the teachers essentially look petty, that it was more about the appointment of Engler, which they didn't approve, than it was about the students and about the survivors of Larry Nassar. But afterwards, you know, a lot of the professors were very clear that this was about the students, that this move, this symbolic vote of theirs was about the board's response to not listening to students, to not protecting the students from sexual assault, and for essentially having Nassar occur under their watch.
Well, we know both of you are staying on top of this developing story, and we really appreciate it. Thank you, Scott Paul and Shayna Roth, for joining me.
Sure thing.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's talk about two legislative efforts that could affect MSU and campuses across our state. First, a proposal by State Representative Erica Geis of Taylor would place an independent person on campuses to hear from students who do not believe their university is taking their sexual misconduct claims seriously. I asked State Representative Geis to explain this person's role and if it could have made a difference at MSU.
So the idea of the ombudsman would be a way for students with Title IX issues, if they're not getting addressed at their university, to have an external space that would protect them from intimidation or retaliation, and it would not be specific to just MSU. While this current issue occurred at MSU, the issues around sexual assault occur on campuses everywhere. And we really want to stress the concept of prevention, protection, and accountability. And so the ombudsman would fall under the umbrella of protection.
Who would oversee the position and how would they be vetted?
Those are some of the pieces that we are working on to make sure that it is a very sound part of the protection umbrella. This isn't something that you can really rush through. It needs to be done well, and it needs to be done in a way that provides the victims and the survivors with as much of a resource that that helps protect them.
If this person had been in place, do you think that would have changed possibly some of the issues we saw here at MSU?
I think it's very possible it would have been another area where victims could have gone. I think we have a big issue with failing to listen to victims when they inform someone that they have been victimized. And it might have added another layer that could have provided them with protection and with relief a lot sooner. It might have prevented additional victims from being victimized over the course of time.
Your bill for this ombudsman, where does it stand in the Michigan State House, and where do you, what's kind of the future path for it right now?
Well, we are working on making sure that the language is good and strong, and working with our colleagues both in the House and in the Senate and on both sides of the aisle, so that when it comes to addressing sexual assault and harassment, that there is a strong set of policies that can be presented and hopefully acted on.
State Representative Erica Geis from Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Reginald.
While her proposal has not made it into committee yet, a bill by State Representative Jason Lauer of Cedar Lake has already had its first hearing. I talked with Representative Lauer about his plan to change how people are chosen to sit on the Board of Trustees for MSU, the University of Michigan, and Wayne State University.
It would switch those from being elected on a statewide basis in a partisan manner to a nonpartisan gubernatorial appointment. But it also would get rid of anybody who's on the current boards and replace them with new appointees after this year's election cycle. And it's important to note that the governor actually appoints 12 out of the 15 universities currently. So this is the way we do it for really all other universities in the state, except for Michigan State, U of M, and Wayne State.
So was MSU's handling of the Nassar case, or the way the trustees picked Governor Engler, part of the reason why you went forward with this?
So this has actually come up a few times in recent memory in the legislature, changing the way that we do this appointment process or election process for these boards. So it's actually something I was working on prior. But then when you took a look at the board's actions and their handling of the Larry Nassar situation, it really made the amendment timely and really bringing it forward now. So I guess it affected the timing, but it was something that I thought was a good idea regardless of the situation.
Right now, Michigan State University's board is split 4-4 Democrat Republican. So is there a concern that if you had a Democratic governor that he or she would elect all Democrats, or a Republican governor would just put all GOP representatives on all these boards for these three major universities?
Sure. So these types of appointments, as outlined in my legislation and for the other 12 boards, are subject to the advice and consent of the Senate, meaning that they have to be, you know, confirmed by the Senate, essentially. So you do have that check and balance on there, but that really hasn't been a problem for the other 12. So if you take a look at Grand Valley, Central Michigan University, Northern Michigan, Michigan Tech, and, you know, you can name through the universities in the state of Michigan that are appointed. That's just never been a problem, because when the governor does an appointment, whether it's a Democrat governor or whether it's a Republican governor, they go through the backgrounds and the resumes, and it's a formal application process, and they try to select an individual that's the most qualified.
I think usually people just kind of breeze through the Board of Trustees on when they're let at the ballot, but maybe because of all the attention here at MSU, you've heard a lot of people say definitely they are going to pay more attention to the Board of Trustees and may even consider running for that. Does this take that voice away from people who don't have connections to be appointed by the governor?
Sure, I think that's a fair question. I think it's important to note that in order for this to go into effect, it would have to be approved by voters. So this can't happen just through the Michigan House of Representatives or the Senate or the current governor signing into law. It's not the normal process, because it actually takes an amendment to our state constitution.
Thank you, State Representative James Lauer of the 70th District here in Michigan, for joining me today.
Great to be on. Thank you.
We are keeping a close eye on the fallout from the Nassar investigation at MSU. Click on WKAR.org to see updated stories at the top of our homepage. One of MidMichigan's largest healthcare providers is about to get smaller. Sparrow Health Systems has announced it will close the emergency department at its St. Lawrence campus in Lansing on or after May 1st. Sparrow is pledging to offset the shutdown by adding facilities at its main hospital. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports.
Todd Haywood is a familiar name around Lansing. He's an investigative journalist for the Lansing City Pulse, a former Lansing Community College trustee, and a passionate activist for HIV awareness. Haywood is himself HIV positive, so taking meticulous care of his personal health is a must.
What would normally be an average infection for most people could quickly turn into a massive infection for me.
Haywood is well acquainted with the Sparrow St. Lawrence Emergency Department just a few blocks from his home. He has high praise for the team there. Haywood says he's afforded a level of personal attention at St. Lawrence he can't get elsewhere, and that's crucial to someone with a compromised immune system.
This is my go-to for emergency care, and I am troubled at the plans right now, because the risk to my health being stuck in the middle of an emergency room with people who are sick is just, it's extraordinary.
Haywood is not the only one in Lansing with his eye on the Sparrow. Health professionals, too, are concerned with the hospital's plan to shift emergency services to its main campus on Michigan Avenue, 1.8 miles away. Jeff Breslin sees the distance as a hurdle for residents who rely on their proximity to St. Lawrence. He's a registered nurse and president of the Sparrow Professional Employee Council, a division of the Michigan Nurses Association.
Maybe they have a sick child during the middle of the night, and if they don't have a car, they don't have public transportation because it doesn't run all night, 1.8 miles, that's insurmountable.
Breslin recognizes that in Lansing and nationwide, many people seek treatment at local emergency departments, even for what may be deemed routine care. Often that's because they don't have their own primary care physician. But Breslin says you can't fault them for not having extensive medical training.
To say, hey, you can't come here because this is not a true emergency, is asking them to make decisions that they're not qualified for. We're the experts, and that's why they come in to see us.
Sparrow officials declined to be interviewed for this story, But in a written statement, the company says it will add 11 new treatment areas to the 62 existing beds in the ER at the main campus. Additionally, Sparrow plans to open a new 10-bed urgent care center across the street. Leanne Heilig wonders if it will be enough. She's an RN in Sparrow's main emergency room.
There's many days that we are so full in the emergency department. Chairs are being occupied in the hallways. There's stretchers in the hallways. There's literally no place to put another patient unless they want to sit on the floor. And that is not sanitary or safe for anybody.
Heilig says management has told her and her colleagues that those 11 treatment centers will be specifically dedicated to mental health patients. Of those 11, she says, 5 will be actual rooms and 6 will be reclining chairs. Sparrow's plan to shut down the St. Lawrence ER is an unsettling proposition for many who live in Lansing's West Side neighborhood.
Some people are outraged.
That's 4th Ward City Councilman Brian T. Jackson, who says he's reached out to Sparrow to urge them to keep an open mind. Jackson says he's not aware of any past efforts by Sparrow to talk with the city to find some economic relief that might prevent the closure, but he'd like to have those conversations.
With a corporation the size of Sparrow, I hate to see that it's a money decision when we're talking about people's lives and health. So hopefully we can stay at the table and possibly work something out.
As Sparrow finalizes its plans, Councilman Jackson is soliciting community input. The St. Lawrence Emergency Department closure is at the top of his agenda for his next constituents meeting. In the long term, Sparrow's decision is certain to leave its mark on a healthcare landscape that's set to change even more dramatically in the coming years. In December, Sparrow rival McLaren Healthcare announced that it will build a new 240-bed hospital near the Michigan State University campus. That project will eventually phase out McLaren's 2 existing sites in Lansing. Groundbreaking is expected later this year. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
The Sparrow St. Lawrence Emergency Department closure will be discussed at the next 4th Ward constituent meeting. That meeting will be held Saturday, February 24th at Gregory's Restaurant on North Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Lansing. It starts at 10 a.m. From Reconstruction to the Civil Rights Movement to now, a new documentary shows the triumphs and struggles of historically Black colleges and universities.
And I was able to do it in an environment where I was free from judgment because I happened to be, you know, a Black girl from the city of Detroit.
Next, 2 Michiganders tell us why they chose to head down south for higher education. And later, a way you can join in on the New Year's celebrations around the world without leaving the capital region. You're listening to Current State from WKAR News. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR News, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Although Michigan State University graduated its first Black woman in 1907, many colleges did not allow African Americans to even register until the 1960s. So it was up to dozens of historically Black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, to train future teachers, doctors, lawyers, and other professionals from after slavery until today. A new documentary premieres Monday at 9 p.m. on WKAR TV 23. It's called Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities. And here's a little bit of the trailer.
Laws existed that prevented African Americans from learning how to read.
Who gonna control our education? Who we gonna let white folks control it, or Black people?
Despite the violence and intimidation, the Black colleges survived. Black people were in charge.
If you come here, you will find something you won't find anyplace else.
My next 2 guests are Detroit natives who attended HBCUs. Nikki Taylor attended Grambling State University. She joins us via Skype. Thank you for joining us on Current State, Nikki.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And joining us on the phone is Io Thomas, who attended Fisk University in Tennessee and is currently pursuing a master's degree at MSU. Thank you for joining us, Io.
Thank you for having me.
Nikki, I want to ask you first, what led you to pursue going to an HBCU as opposed to staying right here in state?
Well, initially, what sparked my interest in historically Black colleges and universities was a show titled A Different World. Quite honestly, it aired after The Cosby Show on Thursday nights at 8:30 p.m. And that was my first introduction to Hillman College, which is a fictional college, but it really gave me some insight and the initial and foundational knowledge of historically Black colleges and universities. So that, coupled with the fact that my high school years were not enjoyable by any stretch of the imagination, I was bullied very badly. And looking back, that was one of the, if I had a reason, 1A and 1B, those would be the two reasons. I wanted to get as far away from the student population where I had went to high school, and choosing a historically Black college or university, I knew I would be going south. So one, I wanted to attend, and two, I wanted to get far, far away.
How about you, Ayo?
Well, for me, I come from a family of HBCU graduates, so it was almost a natural decision for me. And of course, there are no HBCUs in the Michigan area, but I was also interested in the change of scenery and a change of climate, if you will. So I began to look at schools in other places, and actually for Fisk specifically, really quickly, I filled out a common application, and then I started getting mail from them. But it was my experience with the alumni that really made the decision for me.
So, Nikki, when you talk to people and you say you graduated from an HBCU, what are the kind of questions that you get and some of the myths that you have to dispel?
So oftentimes I either get someone who knows who Eddie Robinson was, one of the winningest coaches in football collegiate history, not just HBCU history, but his historical wins ended at 408. So if you love the sport of football, especially college football, that's usually where people tie in Grambling State University directly with Coach Eddie Robinson. And if you are not a football fan, I am often left to answer questions about where it's located. Why did you go so far away from school? Did you feel like you got an adequate education? Things that you would think a person that had some sort of common sense would not ask, since the university is accredited.
How about you, Ayo? How do you educate folks in a sense when they kind of throw to you an awkward question or even just want to learn out of curiosity?
My greatest asset has been just sharing my experience, talking about what I've done with the information that I gained and was afforded to me through my education at Fisk. And so I start with that. I also then like to share different things that are unexpected that people may not realize have been impacted by Fisk and graduates of Fisk since our founding 151 years ago.
What some may not know is that Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall graduated from an HBCU. Here's another portion from the documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising.
Thurgood Marshall was widely regarded to be someone who had a big personality and someone who could persuade people by charm. These are some of the raw skills that Charles Hamilton Houston took and refined and turned into one of the most significant lawyers of our generation.
Shortly after Thurgood Marshall graduates from Howard Law School, he and Dean Houston take a road trip, and they head into the recesses of the Deep South.
This segment of the documentary goes on to explain how restructuring the Howard Law School led to the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case that desegregated schools. So let's turn back to our two Detroit natives who attended historically Black colleges or universities, Nikki Taylor and Ayo Thomas. Nikki, what was your impression of the documentary?
I absolutely loved it. I thought it was, first of all, a lot of the film footage that was used for the documentary has never been seen before. So to know that there is this type of information that was not only found and put so impactfully into a documentary was just very moving to me. They addressed everything from why HBCUs were founded and kind of carried that story up through the 80s. I enjoyed the fact that the film, I felt as if it was left open-ended so that someone else can maybe come along and pick up the documentary or something similar from the 90s up into where we are now. So I enjoyed the historical information. Some of the information that was presented, I was very aware of. But one of the facts that struck me awe was the students who protested or sat in at the Woolworth lunch counters. I had no idea that those students were from North Carolina A&T.
Many HBCU graduates are asked about racial diversity on campus. In a Pew Research Center report last year, 17% of students at these universities are white, Hispanic, Asian, or Native American. But our Detroit native, HBCU grads Nikki Taylor and Io Thomas, also told me that HBCUs display something rarely talked about, the wide diversity within the African American community.
All Black people are not the same. So while we may all be from the same race, we all come from different cultural experiences and makeup. So Black people in Detroit are not the same as Black people maybe in Mississippi. Mississippi Black people may have different cultural experiences from someone who's from Compton, California, and so on and so forth. So you'll have a very huge melting pot of same race of people, but just a different experience. And so within that, you will also find students of other races. So anyone is welcome.
I'll say absolutely that the idea of diversity goes far beyond the demographic check boxes that we're used to in mainstream. So the idea that somehow Black culture is homogenous is absolutely false, as would be the same for any group of people and for any culture. So I would say that that's absolutely the first thing that I am reminded of when I think of my time on campus.
And with that, I want to thank our guests, HBCU grads Nikki Taylor and Io Thomas. Taylor graduated from Grambling State University and organizes the HBCU Detroit chapter.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And Thomas graduated from Fisk University in Nashville and is also pursuing a graduate degree from MSU.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, the Indy Lens presentation of Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities, airs Monday night at 9 o'clock on WKAR-TV 23 here in the Capital Region.
Take me out to the ball game.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR News. Well, there's plenty of snow here in the Capital Region, but spring has arrived for baseball fans as pitchers and catchers report to spring training in Florida and Arizona. Fans have a pretty good idea of what spring training means to the major leaguers, but what about the minor leaguers and the teams they'll play for? WKAR Scott Pohl talks with Nick Greaser, president of the Lansing Lugnuts, the Midwest League affiliate of the Toronto Blue Jays. He says there isn't much difference between the spring training regimen for the pros and the minor leaguers.
What is a little unknown is, you know, where they're going to be. So they might have an idea. For example, a guy that we had last year, if he came in late at the end of the season, he might have an idea that he's coming back. He might have the hopes to go to high A. He might want to go to double A. So obviously the major league guys, they kind of know. Obviously, they know the guys that are returning. They probably have some assumptions on the 40-man roster. For our guys, it's really trying to fight for position. So it's a big difference between here and high A, where they start out. So it's almost like a tryout for the minor league guys. You know, there's some preconceived notions where they're going, but they're really fighting for a roster spot at what they conceive to be the next level. They can only house so many guys at the major league level, and so there's, you know, at least four affiliates in full-season ball that are trying to fill their rosters as well. It's essentially a six-week tryout.
So a player who played at the A level last year, mm-hmm. or is likely to play at the A level this year, when they get to, say, Florida, first of all, do the Blue Jays train in Florida?
They do, Dunedin, right outside Tampa.
Okay. when they report, do they interact with the guys who know they're going to be on the Blue Jays major league roster? How does that work?
Yeah, to my, and you know, working in baseball, we're also extremely busy right now. So I haven't been to spring training since I was a kid, unfortunately. It's sad to say 17 years in baseball, I haven't been to spring training since I've been working in it. But yes, they basically have, they're all housed in the same complex. At least, not, I believe every affiliate is a little different. As far as the Blue Jays, they have all, everybody's housed in the same area. They have a major league complex. And then right next door is the minor league complex. So as far as interaction, yeah, I'm sure they're they're talking with the guys, interacting. I know as far as some of the games that they'll bring some guys back and forth between the two different clubs essentially, as far as kind of the minor league roster and the major league roster. There is some crossover, but a guy that, you know, just got drafted last year, unless, you know, Vladdy Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, they may have some plays on the major league club, but for the average single A guy, they're probably staying within their own realm with the minor league side.
You've touched on a question I was going to ask you, and that is whether representatives of the Lansing Lugnuts organization go to Florida or need to go to Florida. Sure. You haven't been yourself. Does the Lugnuts organization send anyone to Florida during spring training?
You know, the Blue Jays have been a great partner. They invite us every year. And, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of my peers and other teams do go down. I always have a hard time fitting in my schedule, to be quite honest, as our busiest time of the year is probably the 6 or 8 weeks leading up to opening day. And a lot of people don't realize that, is we're trying to get, one, the ballpark opened up, as we've got snow on the field right now, but also getting our marketing efforts going and all of our sales efforts going. So we kind of handle all the entertainment side of the business outside of the sport, and this is our busiest time. But, you know, from year to year, we have had some folks go down. Our groundskeeper's gone down from time to time to kind of work with the major league groundskeepers and get to know our players a little bit. Our broadcaster has gone down over the years to help to get to know the players and kind of their backstories and things. I believe our owner is going down this year. So while they invite us every year, we don't, you know, typically send somebody every year, but there's, over the years, there's been some different people that have gone down to kind of help out.
Does a minor league team like the Lansing Lugnuts open the regular season at about the same time as the major leaguers?
Yeah, we're a few days behind. So I believe the majors open on that Monday, the April 2nd. We open on the road this year on Thursday, April 5th, up in Midland with the Great Lakes Loons. And then our home opener is April 7th. And since we've moved our annual exhibition game, the Crosstown Showdown, we moved that to the fall permanently. So now we've been really promoting and you know, trying to have an all-in event for opening day. Hopefully the weather works out the way it did last year. It was 70 degrees and beautiful last year on our opening day. We had a great response from the community. We're doing a very similar model, having a big block party out front. We're doing our Meet the Team event that same time. We're having live music out here. We're having a lot of entertainment out front. Everybody coming to the ballpark. We've got some specials going on for opening night, and then we're doing Lafke fireworks following the game as well. So we're excited about it. We're hoping that we can create an atmosphere like the major leagues do in their respective cities, to where Lansing Lugnuts opening day becomes a citywide event. I think we're also realistic to know that that's not going to happen overnight. But since we haven't really focused on opening day in about a decade, so now that the Crosstown has been moved, that's a focus of ours. But yeah, we're that same week as the majors. We open that fifth.
Now, you don't know yet what players will be on your roster, but the coaching staff is set. What can you tell us about the coaching staff?
Sure. Cesar Martin is returning as his second year as our manager. Great guy to work with. He's a great coach. He's what you call a player's coach. So he really looks after his guys. And at this level, that's extremely important. Is, you know, you get a lot of people don't realize that a lot of our players, 18 to 21, 22 years old, a lot of times it's their first experience. You know, and we're the first season of full season professional baseball, so we play 140 game schedule. There's a couple of levels below us that play in the 86 game schedule. So for these guys, it's just as mental as it is physical. So obviously, all these guys that are here, they've got the talent. It's really understanding all the extracurriculars, and that's been a big focus of the Blue Jays the last couple of years, is as they've brought in what they call a high performance team, which is everything really off the field. They've got, you know, everything from a dietitian to strength and conditioning coaches to guys that work with them on their vision and more of holistic approaches to things. They've got a mental health coach, they call it, just to make sure their head's right in the game. So, and Blue Jays aren't alone in that. That's a common model with a lot of teams anymore. But that's been a big, big focus of them, and Cesar plays right into that. So the rest of the coaching staff is relatively new. We actually have Antonio Caceres, who was our pitching coach, I believe, in the 2010 or 2011 season, so making a return. We have a new hitting coach, a new trainer. So it's a lot of new guys down there this year. But Cesar's coming back for a second year, which is nice to have some continuity there.
And the Blue Jays have some say in the coaching staff, I assume.
They have the say. So much like our players, where in affiliated minor league baseball, you know, my job as – I was our GM for the last 7 years. I'm now our team president. My job is really to facilitate the players, make them comfortable here. All of the on-field decisions are really made by the Blue Jays. Everything from promotions and demotions to starting pitchers to whether we're playing small ball or not, that's really all done by the Blue Jays. So it's a big misconception about what we do here locally. We're really the entertainment venue. So we have more to do with what our LAFCU fireworks schedule is and what our giveaways are than the wins and losses on the field, unfortunately. And the good thing is that, you know, for my world, we can control the entertainment side of things. It's really hard for me to control the on-field results, and our fan base really comes for a good time more than wins and losses, which is great continuity throughout the year. You don't have to worry if we're on a 7-game losing streak. Doesn't really matter to our average fan. Of course, we have people that care and that want to see the team win, as do we. But you know, you're not leaving here upset on a Saturday night if the team loses and you brought your family out and had a good time.
Well, I have to tell you, with the amount of snow we've gotten this winter, and this morning as you and I talk, the wind chill is in the single digits. I'm so happy to be talking about baseball and spring. I want to thank you, Nick Greaser, for talking with us. Nick is president of the Lansing Lugnuts. Thanks, and good luck this season.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Just ahead, memories of a Michigan State University president who stared down one of the school's toughest economic times. Also, meet the Spartan behind one of the largest gifts to ever be given by a professional athlete to any college or university.
So I learned a lot about life, tough love, but it is what I was used to, and it drew me to Michigan State.
And later, learn how to celebrate the new year like you were in Shanghai or Beijing without leaving the capital region.
Yes, biggest time of year. It has been a tradition for thousands of years, you know.
Stay with Current State right here on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
My first day at the state capitol, I was shocked by the informality of it all. You think, ooh, government, those halls must be so hallowed, so quiet and formal. Oh no, people are wandering around and yelling and joking, and at the front of the room is one person just trying to get some order. I'm Shayna Roth. Tune into WKAR to get a less noisy take on what's going on at the state capitol.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR News, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We learned this week that former Michigan State University President Cecil Mackey Jr. died at the age of 89 on February 8th. WKAR Scott Pohl joins me now to help us remember Cecil Mackey.
Hi, Reginald.
So, Scott, when was Cecil Mackey president here at MSU?
Well, he became president in 1979 and served until 1985. Prior to that, he had been president at two other colleges, the University of South Florida and at Texas Tech. Cecil Mackey was from Alabama. He got degrees in economics from the University of Alabama and a doctorate from the University of Illinois. Later on, he got a law degree from the University of Alabama.
Not a lot of people serve in several military branches. He had quite the military background.
It's really kind of amazing. He was in the Alabama National Guard. He also served in the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Air Force. He later taught at the Air Force Academy, and he also taught at the University of Alabama.
What was MSU like during his time as president?
Well, when he got here in 1979, there was a $30 million deficit, and that was a big number in those days. That meant that among his first actions were some tough budgetary decisions. Maybe the most controversial thing that he proposed was eliminating the College of Nursing to save money. Ultimately, the college was downsized rather than closed down. But that meant there were certain elements that were unhappy with him early on, but he had to face this deficit and deal with it. And with his economics background, a lot of people had faith in his judgment on those matters. There were some major projects during his time as president, including the opening of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts and the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory.
So what did Cecil Mackey do after leaving the president's office?
Well, he and his wife, Claire, stayed here in East Lansing. He continued to teach economics classes at MSU, and they remained visible in the community quite a bit. In fact, Cecil Mackey played a lot of tennis. He was a big tennis fan. I would see him at MSU tennis matches. And I want to recognize Claire Mackey because she too was very visible in the community. And here in our hallways here at WKAR, she
was someone that we would see at certain times when we had volunteers in and out at the station. She volunteered here and did other volunteer work in the community. Really engaging, friendly woman, anxious to help. And so I want to make sure that folks know how highly respected Claire Mackey has been over the years.
So no one on our team knows MSU like you do, Scott. So do you have any personal thoughts on Cecil Mackey?
Well, he became president the same year I graduated from Michigan State University. And when I started here at WKAR, he was president. And I can only tell you that every time I ever encountered Cecil Mackey, it was a pleasant experience. He could be the kind of person who would disagree with you, but not be disagreeable while he was at it. He had a certain Southern charm, I think it's safe and fair to say. So I think that he has a pretty high regard amongst the MSU community that has been here this many years.
Well, thank you, Scott, for your perspective. And I understand, again, Cecil Mackey is the signature on your diploma, right?
Yes, yes.
Thank you again, Scott Pohl, for our WKAR news team. Former MSU President Cecil Mackey died on February 8th. He was 89 years old. There will be a memorial service at a later date here in East Lansing, and he'll be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Again, Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
In 1997, Steve Smith, a former MSU basketball All-American and member of the 2003 NBA champion San Antonio Spurs, donated $2.5 million towards the construction of the Clara Bell Smith Student Athlete Academic Center. This donation, in memory of his mother, Clara Bell Smith, is the largest gift to be ever given by a professional athlete to any college or university. This donation helped fund the construction of a comprehensive study center for student-athletes at MSU. WKAR contributor Russ White caught up with Smith on campus.
You know, we were the first back then, so that was very special. And then I also understood of being an athlete before the Student Athletic Center was built on campuses and how much I saw the future of how much it would help and how much that you'll get a chance to interact with your professors and how much, you know, as of for now, for me, even personally, to have student athletes come and say thank you. And then I think also for me, it was a way to give back to this community, a community where I grew up in Detroit and so fond of, and have a scholarship fund also attached to it. And then also to get a chance to see how well it's done and how well it's helped recruiting, not just basketball, you know, all sports, and not recruiting for so much for the kids come here, the athletics, but to hear the parents talk about, you know, I love that for my child, you know, outside of basketball. And obviously we're student athletes, but I always tell people the student becomes before athlete. So take that very serious, because you're going to be a student in life much longer than you're going to be an athlete. Even if you have a long career, we are always life-learning students, in my opinion.
Smith's generosity set an example for other Spartans to give back to MSU.
It's contagious. You take, after my gift to the university, we have just the guys I know, and it's been tremendous, a lot of them, that I think, you know, obviously we should give everybody credit, but to highlight some of the Irvin has done so much. And then Flozell Adams, and then obviously what almost brought a tear to my eye when I got the news about Draymond, even though I kind of knew there was something in the works, didn't know when it was actually coming. But for me to be at the Hall of Fame and receive an award kind of for giving, and then to hear the Draymond, and then for me to be proud and stick my chest out and say, hey, not a lot of universities are doing this. And then to come back the next day, I came to the Oregon game, and to get a chance to, you know, to tell him I'm proud of him. And obviously we speak a lot, but I've been knowing him since he was junior in high school, and just to see the way he's developed. And he's his own man. He's his own man. It wasn't him following my act. It was him. That's Draymond. You know, that's Draymond Green. And I tell people that was him. You know, I had my day. You know, I can step back and be proud like I'm Uncle Steve now and get a chance to see all the the development.
Steve Smith says his path to MSU began with fellow Detroiter Greg Kelser and the Spartans' 1979 national championship.
You know, and obviously growing up in Detroit, the first, I guess my first connection to Michigan State was, you know, and obviously in 78, 79. And I tell people Greg Kelser first, because Greg Kelser was a kid from Detroit that I used to hear about from my brothers, and they talked about his game. And then obviously the headliner and Irvin Magic Johnson. So those two guys, and then they won a national championship. And I can remember, I was young, I think I was 10 then, my family jumping around and just us gathering around the television. And obviously you throw in the Larry Bird aspect, Bird versus Magic, and Greg Kelser got a chance to win a national championship from the city of Detroit. So that was my first love. And then obviously me playing basketball, and as time went on, this little guy just kept coming around, Tom Izzo, just kept coming around. And he won me over, and I was his first recruit. I was his actually first recruit he ever signed. And because we all know, and I can speak candidly about this, Judd wasn't really recruiting back then. He just, you want to come, you come. But Tom put in the hard work, and then the combination of what I learned on the court with Judd and Tom and the coaching staff, and I tell people, I was blessed to have the general, the crazy man, and Judd. So I learned a lot about life, tough love, but it is what I was used to, and it drew me to Michigan State.
Chúc mừng năm mới. That is Happy New Year in Vietnamese, which is half of my heritage. This weekend, many Asian American families will be ushering in the Chinese New Year. It's the Year of the Dog. And joining me to talk about a local celebration this weekend is Ying Bear, Vice President of the Greater Lansing Chinese Association. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
So there is a huge Chinese New Year celebration at Meridian Township this weekend. Tell us kind of the specifics of when and where, what's going to go on.
The location is at Meridian Mall, right in the center of the mall. And it starts from 1 p.m. It lasts until it ends. We planned it to be end at 4:30, probably last longer. And during the event, there will be line dance, dragon dance. There will be all sorts of performances, including Chinese classical dance, solo singing, group singing, orchestra, and fashion show. So all sorts of activities simultaneously going on. There will be also a raffle ticket drawing. And the first prize I would like to mention is 50-inch TV.
Oh, wow. And what about the dragon dance? What are kind of the traditions behind that?
Okay, the dragon dance. Dragon is a symbol for wealth, power, prosperity in Chinese culture. And the Chinese dragon is quite different from the Western dragon. The Chinese dragon is long, usually gold or red, with a big head, always chasing a pearl. And it's symbolic for our culture. We are called the descendant of the dragon. So we always have a dragon dance. And this year, the dragon dance is performed by old dragon dance team from our local elementary school, Cornell Elementary School.
So tell me the significance of the New Year celebration in Asian culture. I mean, it is the biggest time of the year.
You know? Yes, the biggest time of the year. It has been a tradition for thousands of years. You know, when the time changes, the garment switches, so everything changes, except we always preserve this Chinese New Year. It's something people recognize, not just in China, but in entire Asia, Korea and other surrounding countries like Vietnam and Singapore, Malaysia, they all celebrate exactly the same date, the same holiday. You can see the significance of this holiday. It's like a family thing. Yesterday, my husband asked me, what do people do? People go to see other people, friends? I said, no, people stay with their family. It's more like a Thanksgiving, a family-oriented holiday, but a lot more significant holiday. And I would like to invite everyone there and have fun. If you think you're a good singer or you can perform, please join us.
And again, that is Ying Bear, Vice President of the Greater Lansing Chinese Association. And we have all the details about the Chinese New Year celebration at Meridian Township Mall
on our website, WKAR.org. And with that, we bring another current state to a close. For the entire WKAR News team, I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We will connect with you next weekend.